Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and on this Memorial Day, we begin in Iraq. South of Baghdad today, suicide bombers struck at a crowd of Iraqi policemen protesting the government's decision to disband their special forces unit. Up to 30 people were killed. Meanwhile, Operation Lightning, a major Iraqi-led offensive against the insurgents, is in its second day. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Washington Post reporter Jonathan Feiner. Jonathan, there have been many car bombs of late. How unusual is it that these were suicide bombers, and do we know any more about them?
Not particularly unusual this month. There have been tons and tons of suicide bombings across the country throughout the month of May. Something like 700 people or more have now been killed in these attacks. What was unusual about these attacks is that two of the bombers, it appears, detonated themselves simultaneously as they walked among this crowd of police protesters. And then the third bomber waited until people, survivors, started to run to a nearby building to look for shelter. And he ran with them and then blew himself up as well.
Do we know any more about who's claiming responsibility?
Well, the Zarqawi group, Abu Musab Zarqawi's insurgent organization called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has claimed responsibility in an internet posting. They now claim responsibility for most every attack that takes place in Iraq, and it's very difficult to verify these things, but the website that's posted their claim tends to be one that insurgents use to spread information, so it may well be reliable.
And while we're on the topic, what is the status of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, again, the Jordanian insurgent leader and leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, was said to be seriously injured last week?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think the U.S. military is trying to figure that out, as are Iraq security forces. There have been fairly credible reports that he's pretty badly injured. We have sources telling us that he was shot in the lung. There were reports that he had fled Iraq to get medical treatment in some other country. We've also heard from some of our sources that he's actually remained in the country. Some conflicting reports as well about whether or not he's still running the organization. There were some reports that a deputy had been named, and we've also heard that he is still very much in charge.
Well, Jonathan, tell us more about Operation Lightning. This is the offensive that began yesterday. The goal, according to Iraq's prime minister, to surround Baghdad like a bracelet around a wrist. Tell us more about it.
Well, the way it's been described to us is that 40,000 Iraqi security forces are going to be sweeping through the city. It appears they started in the west, where there were some clashes yesterday afternoon and last night. The insurgents launched some counterattacks in some of these cities, attacking a police barracks where there were some insurgents actually held prisoner, trying to get them freed, but they were unsuccessful in doing that. We've been trying very hard to get information about what exactly has been accomplished so far in this operation from the Iraqi government. One of the interesting things about the operation is that it's being led by Iraqi forces, but their PR infrastructure is also not as accomplished as the American military. So we've been having trouble getting information. We've sent reporters out in the streets to sort of look for where these incidents are taking place. And it's very clear that it's not the entire city just yet, but they're certainly proceeding from one sector to another looking for insurgent hideouts.
Well, and again, you know, you sort of alluded to it, but how does this Operation Lightning, which General Richard Myers, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says is a significant step towards Iraq's security forces taking over responsibility for security in Iraq, how does it jibe with the attacks that we're hearing about, including the ones against the police today?
Well, before the operation was launched, the government sort of laid the groundwork and prepared, I think, people to some extent, or tried to prepare people for the possibility that insurgents would respond to this operation by launching more attacks to demonstrate their operations weren't being shut down. So government spokespeople definitely said that this was going to happen, although I'm not sure that they expected the ferocity with which insurgents have sort of struck back.
How are people in Baghdad responding to Operation Lightning?
Well, the people that we spoke with yesterday seemed to welcome it. Baghdad, more so than most other Iraqi cities during this pretty horrible month in terms of violence, has been struck by attack after attack after attack, and I think for some people enough was enough. Now, of course, there were some inconveniences associated with an operation like this. More checkpoints means more traffic, the occasional sort of search of neighborhoods and homes that drives people nuts sometimes. But at the same time, the people that we spoke with seemed very much to be happy about the increased security presence and the sign that the government seemed at long last to finally be trying to do something about this.
And by the way, Jonathan, a Westerner in Baghdad, is there any sense in the Western press that this is Memorial Day? Is there, or do you feel detached from that?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I think probably if we were out with the troops, there'd be much more of a sense of that. You know, when you're living kind of on your own in the city like this, you sort of lose, and we sometimes don't even know what day of the week it is, weekends, weekdays, it all sort of blends together. But certainly, you know, reminded of a holiday as important as that. I mean, it's certainly hard to forget given where we are and the sort of sheer number of troops that are over here sort of risking their lives. So it's something we're aware of, but certainly not something, you know, we're in a position to celebrate necessarily.
Jonathan Feiner, a reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Baghdad. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
From the realities of today's war to war as seen through a filmmaker's camera lens, from the battlefields of the Civil War to the urban warfare seen in Baghdad, film in America has both reflected public sentiment and helped shape it. Here now's Deborah Becker recently sat down with Ted Barron, he's the managing director of the Harvard Film Archive, to look at a century worth of war on film.
Let's talk about some of the early films that really established war films as sort of a genre. What would you say was the first that was memorable?
Well, I mean, war films go back to the origins of cinema. I mean, in the late 1890s, you had short films that dealt with the Spanish-American War. But really, the first major narrative film is really what is considered the first major narrative film, Birth of a Nation, which was a film by D.W. Griffith, a very controversial film, which was designed as a commemoration of the Civil War, a 50-year anniversary, and features within it several very detailed graphic battle sequences, which become in many ways a kind of blueprint for what later emerges as the genre of the war film.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened next? How did it develop, and what films can we look to and sort of see that development?
Well, I mean, Birth of a Nation comes right around the time of World War I, and the only other film that you see is another film by Griffith titled Hearts of the World, which was interestingly a film that he was commissioned to make by the British and French government to encourage U.S. entry into the war. But World War I is almost sort of too real for people to start dealing with, at least in Hollywood. I mean, you see it in other parts of the world. So it's not for another 10 years that you start to see a wave of World War I films like The Big Parade, What Price Glory, and Wings, which was one of the first major Academy Award-winning films. These were films which, again, tended to follow a kind of similar rubric in the sense that you'd have two soldiers from different walks of life who would be brought into the horrors of battle and reunited in the effort, and usually torn apart by a woman that they were both in love with.
It always happens.
Yes.
And then we have World War II films.
Right, which, you know, there's a pretty big gap there, but World War II films are really interesting because you really see a mobilization of the Hollywood film industry behind the war effort. So that, you know, where you have films that are actually co-produced by branches of the government or branches of the military.
Right, like They Were Expendable. We actually have a clip from the movie. That was the movie directed by John Ford in 1945 with Robert Montgomery and John Wayne, and it takes place in the South Pacific and begins right before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. It follows the story of a PT boat squadron that took on Japanese destroyers, and this is the last scene from the movie that we're about to hear, and that's when Americans were leaving the Philippines.
Sir, how many more planes are coming in?
None. Look, son, we're going home to do a job. And that job is to get ready to come back. Check.
Check. Check.
It's pretty indicative of the kinds of films that were made during the war. It's very black and white. The U.S. was on the side of what was right, and you know, the bad guys were the bad guys, and John Wayne was always there to hunt them down and kill them.
And right before the credits rolled there, General MacArthur's famous quote, "We shall return," was actually put on the screen.
Yeah? Right,
right. So it was common to have this sort of...
It's an interesting sort of blend of sort of real life and this, you know, very, very fictionalized version of events which took place, and where, you know, you had this sort of the real life reference of the war, but used in very kind of traditional Hollywood narrative settings.
And when was it, do you think, that we started to see sort of the change from these films to inspire patriotism to more social commentary?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, around the world, you start to see the change as early as, you know, it's as early as the 1930s. But in Hollywood, it takes quite a while. I mean, it takes because actually the films that you see emerging from Hollywood in the 1950s and 1960s are largely films that are still about World War II, where the World War II film becomes less of a propagandistic device, but more of a kind of big celebrity vehicle.
And then the Vietnam War was a whole other genre.
That's right. That's right. Where you start to see, well, it's interesting. The only film made during the Vietnam War about Vietnam is The Green Berets, which again stars John Wayne. And of course, it's a very patriotic film, very supportive of the war effort. And looking at film, looking at the war in very black and white terms, like the films from the 40s had done. But it's not until the late 70s where you see the first wave of Vietnam films, which garner critical and some popular acceptance, films like The Deer Hunter, Coming Home, Apocalypse Now, which are obviously very critical of what had happened in Vietnam.
Right. We actually have a clip from The Deer Hunter, a very powerful film. In this scene, Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken are prisoners of war. They're being held in a cage, partially submerged in water, and the Vietnamese soldiers are forcing them to play Russian roulette. De Niro and Walken are up next, and they're trying to come up with a strategy.
Mike, what are you saying?
I'm saying forget him, Nick. Get it through your head, or you and me are both down, too.
I'm waiting. We've
got to play with more bullets.
More bullets than a gun. How many more bullets?
Three. That means we gotta play each other.
More bullets against each other? What are you, crazy?
Nicky, it's the only way.
Oh, that was a very intense movie.
Yeah,
very disturbing.
And one of the more harrowing moments from the film, and about as far away as you could get from the kind of machismo that you saw in 1940s films about, you know, about World War II. You know, these are characters who are put in a much more, you know, morally ambiguous situation. They're deciding to leave one of their comrades behind, which never happens in films prior to this. You know, this is, you know, it's always about sort of saving even the last soldier. And this is, they're put in a situation where, you know, morality is much more compromised.
Right. So maybe the Vietnam War really was where we started to see the most significant change in some of these.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think you see it's especially with, you know, the films that come out in the late 70s, they're much more critical of that patriotic position.
Right. And into the 80s, we had Platoon.
Yeah, Platoon, I think, is an interesting moment in terms of the Vietnam film genre, because it's a film that is, like the films from the 70s, very critical of the war, but it's a film that also gains so much commercial and critical acceptance and sort of marks a moment where the outsiders, who had sort of been positioned as, you know, the outsider anti-war position, becomes much more of a mainstream position and much more acceptable to mainstream audiences.
All right, we have a clip from Platoon as well, and it's the scene in the movie where Willem Dafoe and Charlie Sheen are in Vietnam after there were accusations of unlawful killings by American soldiers.
Barnes has got it in for you, doesn't he?
Barnes believes in what he's doing.
And you? You believe?
In 65? Yeah. Now? No.
So it almost seems as if we're growing up as well, the movie and the folks, the moviegoers. Yeah?
Sure, sure. I mean, it's interesting that Willem Dafoe is seen as the more heroic character. You have two sergeants who are posed as kind of polar opposites. And Willem Dafoe is seen as the more admirable of the two, whereas Tom Berenger, who plays the character who you sort of love to hate in the film, is much more in the tradition of the kind of John Wayne hero of the 1940s. He's very, you know, he's very strong. He's very set in his ways, very convinced that he's doing the right thing.
That's Ted Barron, the managing director of the Harvard Film Archive. He's talking with Here Now's Deborah Becker about the way war films have evolved over the years. When we come back, we'll continue our look at war films, including how baby boomers paid homage to the greatest generation in film tributes, like Saving Private Ryan. And later in the program, the story of a Vietnam vet building his own memorials to soldiers killed in Iraq. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on this Memorial Day, we're taking a look at how one of the most powerful mediums, film, has portrayed war over the generations. As we heard earlier, from the very first feature film, The Birth of a Nation, America has looked to cinema as witness to war. Here Now's Deb Becker recently sat down with Ted Barron of the Harvard Film Archive. We pick up their conversation in the 80s. Now, these were the hawkish days of the Cold War, and Hollywood reflected that with a series of patriotic blockbusters.
In the 80s, when we started to see more feel-good movies, there was Top Gun and there were movies like that.
Yeah, which are kind of weird as war films, in part because they're Cold War films. I mean, they're sort of the war films that are about the war that doesn't really exist.
This is it, Maverick!
I'm going to hit the brakes, he'll fly right by.
He's going to get a lock on us!
Now!
So you have this very bizarre moment in Top Gun near the end where Tom Cruise is suddenly fighting with Russian fighter pilots, which, you know, seems to come out of nowhere. These films seem to be carrying on the tradition of those earlier Hollywood films in a much more deliberate way than perhaps some of the other films that are about much more directly about Vietnam.
Right. And then it seems to also have changed when we got to Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, I think Saving Private Ryan is another interesting sort of moment because it comes around the time of a lot of the commemoration of World War II, the 50th anniversary. So you have, you know, Tom Brokaw's, you know, very famous book, The Greatest Generation, and this film is seen as a kind of tribute to the soldiers who fought in World War II, specifically those who fought in Normandy.
We have a clip from Saving Private Ryan. This is a scene from the end of the film where a now elderly Private Ryan visits the grave of a platoon leader who saved him.
To be honest with you, I wasn't sure how I'd feel coming back here. Every day I think about what you said to me that day on the bridge. I've tried to live my life the best I could. I hope that was enough. I hope that at least in your eyes, I've earned what all of you have done for me.
Sounds like we're apologizing a little bit there, huh?
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, it's an interesting position because it's sort of these, you know, the former kind of 60s radical position becomes more mainstream and then sort of has to apologize for not appreciating what their fathers had done before them. So this is in many ways an attempt to sort of make up for the sins of the past.
Right. And how did we go from there, do you think, to the popularity of the documentary?
Well, I think Saving Private Ryan lays the groundwork in an interesting way in terms of what it does formally. I mean, what's generally regarded about the film is this very graphic opening sequence at the invasion of Normandy, where you see events unfold in what's seen as kind of a cinema verite, like truthfulness. That in many ways sort of sets a new standard for the war film in that it's not necessary that you sort of need to dramatize things so much as much as you need to present a real life experience of war. So more recently, what we've seen in representing the war is films like Fahrenheit 9/11 and Control Room, films which are very critical of the recent war in Iraq.
Right. We have a clip from Control Room, a scene where one of the employees from Al Jazeera, Hassan Ibrahim, is talking about the impact of the war on terror on the Arab world.
Saddam was threatening the U.S. with weapons of mass destruction?
Yes.
When? That's news to me. I'm sorry. Now here, this is news to me.
Okay.
When did Saddam threaten the U.S. with weapons of mass destruction?
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. We believe he had the will to give them the forces to use against us. And, well, go ahead.
I'm just conveying to you what people are saying. They're saying that the U.S. is inventing a purpose as it goes along. At the beginning, it was weapons of mass destruction, and then the whole thing transformed into removing Saddam from power.
We're not here to occupy an Arab land. We're not here to take their oil. We're not here to kill Arabs or take mosque or any of the other myriad of reasons.
Is it surprising to you that documentaries like Control Room, which obviously wasn't as successful as Fahrenheit 9/11, but popular nonetheless, that they are this popular right now? And why do you think that is?
I think there's a sense of, you know, the way war is being represented in the media and by the government, that there is a lot of storytelling going on and that people are looking for more truthful representations of war. And Fahrenheit 9/11 is, you know, I would object to sort of calling it an outright truthful representation of the events, but certainly it's perceived as giving a more kind of direct access to what's going on than what we're getting through the kind of filtered messages of government and media.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we'll see movies about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan? Will those be the war movies of the future?
Well, there are some more documentaries coming out. There's a film I'm really interested to see, which is called Why We Fight, directed by Andrew Jarecki, who also directed The Trials of Henry Kissinger. But interestingly, where the films seem to have gone is into these kind of big-budget epic films, which, you know, deal with questions of empire, films like Troy and Alexander, Kingdom of Heaven, films which actually are not very successful commercially in the U.S., but are doing huge numbers outside of the U.S.
We do have a clip from the movie Troy. The leaders from Greece in this clip are talking about attacking the Trojans to expand their empire.
The Trojans have never been conquered. Some say they can't be conquered. Old King Priam thinks he's untouchable behind his high walls. He thinks the sun god will protect him. But the gods protect only We're strong.
It's interesting that the, you know, in terms of the way war is represented these days, is that you have these very polar opposite kinds of representations. It's either the direct feeling of documentary or the very sublimated experience of a historical epic film. But both are kind of dealing with the same issues, dealing with the same questions in a lot of ways.
Right, right. Depending on who you believe.
That's right.
Depending on whose interpretation. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here Now's Deb Becker spoke with Ted Barron, the managing director of the Harvard Film Archive. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Tomorrow on Here and Now, there's lots of opportunities for new graduates with accounting degrees. But what about those liberal arts majors? We'll find out which graduates are finding work. Also, sports writer Ron Rappaport on golfer Bobby Jones. That's tomorrow. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And despite the recent rainy weather here in the Northeast, one man has been working the roads of Holliston, Massachusetts, getting ready for this Memorial Day. Vietnam veteran Robert Blair has been tending to the memorials he erected to honor Americans and their allies killed in Iraq, each one a poster board with the soldier's name, rank, age, and home state. Here Now's Fred Tice joined Robert Blair as he made his rounds last week.
There are some 1,600 memorials lining the roads of Holliston and neighboring towns. Each one has a small flag of the soldier's country. Robert Blair, a mail carrier, puts the memorials up when he gets off work. He starts with a memorial to Captain Chris Sullivan, 29, from Princeton, Massachusetts. He puts it up next to the Holliston post office, where Sullivan's mother worked on occasion.
She would come here to fix the computers, and I had seen her. I don't think I've ever spoken to her, but my postmaster asked me if I wouldn't mind putting it up in front of our post office. Sorry for the mess, but...
In Blair's van, the ashtray is overflowing with cigarettes. Blair, a Vietnam veteran, says his tribute to soldiers killed in Iraq started 2 years ago.
And for a mile and a half, I put them up. There was 147 names. I took and I burned the posters because I figured the war would be over like Desert Storm. And obviously, it didn't end. And everybody kept saying, you're going to do it again. So I had to rewrite that 147. Plus the ones that were killed, and I think last year we put up 880 signs. And through this winter, I would just make the signs up as they were killed. And we added the coalition forces. The mile and a half went to 34.4 miles. Yeah, and we're fortunate we had about 60 volunteers on Sunday come and help put them up. And I wish I had them all right here to help put them up, what the rain has taken down.
Blair has gotten some help putting up the signs. The poster boards are donated by a Holliston printer. The flags are left over from a memorial the town held for victims of 9/11. We stop by the side of the road. A sign in the grass says, Private Jeremy Drexler, 23, Kansas. The American flag that goes with it is lying in the gutter, the rainwater running right through. Blair staples the sign and the muddied flag back onto the telephone pole and starts up the van again. Blair stops again a few hundred feet farther. He lights a cigarette before crossing the road.
I hate to see the flag on the ground. Chief Warrant Officer. Stephen Wells.
25 from Massachusetts.
You can see the water running right off it. It's just saturated. And we did have a case of when we put one up, not long afterwards, someone came out of the house, took the sign and the flag they were seeing, and it makes you wonder what was going through their mind.
think the rain's blowing sideways now.
Blair says some people have had powerful encounters with these signs.
One of the Legion members was putting up signs and in Ashland, and a guy had come off a hill out of his house down to the bottom of the hill, and he couldn't believe it. He got out of the car, and the sign that was right there was someone he graduated college with.
The memorials stretch to 8 different towns now.
I'm afraid to think if we do it next year, how far they go, you know. Maybe we won't need to.
What do you think of the war?
Personally, I try not to get into politics. I have my own personal feelings, but that doesn't have anything to do with supporting the troops. You know, we've had people that have come back from Iraq and have seen the signs up for their dead comrades, and it's a way of showing support. It's a way of showing someone cares. Someone remembers these people, you know, 2 years later. It's kind of a sad way of doing it, but it's a way anyway.
Our story was reported by Here Now's Fred Tise. To see a photograph of Robert Blair working on his memorials, go to our website, here-now.org. When he walked away from the National Football League to join the Army, Pat Tillman was celebrated as a patriotic American. When he was killed in Afghanistan, President Bush praised Tillman's ultimate sacrifice. But Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, reflects now on how the Tillman story has recently become more complicated.
At the end of his splendid new biography of Jim Braddock, one of the more unlikely fighters ever to assume the heavyweight championship, Jeremy Schapp laments that for the popular press, winning the championship wasn't sufficient. He writes, "Braddock was reduced quickly from a real, indomitable human being to a fairy tale cliché." Unhappily, the process of falsifying the story of an athlete for dramatic purposes, and in this case motives considerably darker, is also apparent today. The contemporary victim of the process is Pat Tillman, the former Arizona Cardinals defensive back who gave up a lucrative job in pro football to join the Army. When Tillman was killed in Afghanistan just over a year ago, the U.S. Army Special Operations Command released an inspiring account of his last day, upon which, the report said, Tillman led an attack on enemy forces ambushing his unit. Even at the time that report was issued, the Army knew it was, to borrow Jeremy Schapp's phrase, a fairy tale cliché. Investigators in Afghanistan had already taken testimony from more than a dozen members of Tillman's platoon, indicating that he'd been killed by his fellow Americans, who, in the inevitable confusion of combat, had mistaken him for the enemy. A subsequent Washington Post article citing internal Army documents described Pat Tillman's death as the result of, quote, undisciplined firing by fellow Rangers. It can be argued that the fantasizing of Jim Braddock's rise to pugilistic prominence didn't hurt anybody. The same can't be said of the fraudulent representation of Pat Tillman's death, at least according to Tillman's parents. Mary Tillman told the Washington Post that she felt the military let her son down, that the administration let him down, and that the fact that they lied about what happened to her son was disgusting. Patrick Tillman Sr. was even more forthright. They realized that their recruiting efforts were going to hell in a handbasket if the truth about his death got out, he told the Post. They blew up their poster boy. The true story of Pat Tillman's death doesn't diminish his remarkable decision to trade a pro football job for military service. The falsification of that story, on the other hand, shames those responsible for creating the lie and those recruiters and politicians who capitalized on the story until it fell apart.
Bill Littlefield comments on sports for Here and Now and is host of NPR's Only a Game. You're listening to Here and Now. had to take several days off last week because of a family emergency. The emergency? I had to rescue my mother from life-saving surgery. Perhaps an explanation is in order. My mom suffered her second heart attack 2 years ago. We were all at the movie theater watching the epic Master and Commander when, during a particularly exciting part, the film broke, and the lights came on to reveal Mom wearing little more than her underwear, disoriented and sweating profusely. My brother had been too engrossed in the film to notice Mom disrobing. "I thought she was hot," he said. "She's having a heart attack, you idiot," I hissed. The emergency room staff that first night lived up to their vaunted reputations, but the next day they were replaced by their evil twins. When, in her 15th hour without seeing a doctor, Mom developed an excruciating urinary tract infection, no one would even give her the run-of-the-mill pain medication for fear of offending the invisible doctor should he ever arrive. Mom slipped deeper into a dementia which I think had already started, but from which she's never recovered. At the hospital, they called it sundowners and delirium and ascribed it to her old age. I think she was just plain out of her mind with pain. But either way, I began asking myself, what the hell are we doing to Mom? While we waited for her angioplasty, I watched Mom's elderly roommate sit for 12 hours waiting to be discharged. When her doctor finally came, he bellowed, "After all I did for you, I saved your life. Is this the thanks I get? You want me to rush for you?" Then, "I'm kidding. You know I'm kidding, right?" We all laughed, nervously. Mom came home then with a full-time home health aide. Hilarity ensued. There was the time the aide, newly arrived from Jamaica, bought a set of pretty towels, which turned out to be Hanukkah towels, leading my mother to think that somehow during the heart attack she'd become Jewish. Mom is officially diagnosed with progressive dementia. Last week, when the call came saying that her echocardiogram showed serious leakage in two of her heart valves and that her doctor wanted to put her in the hospital immediately for another test, as her health care proxy, my first question was, to what end? Open-heart surgery, he said. No way, I thought, the first in a series of whiplashing decisions. I began hearing from friends whose parents had successfully undergone heart surgery, and I wavered. Why wouldn't I take advantage of life-saving surgery? Well, because it might kill her. Or, as the admitting doctor said at the hospital the next day, you have to ask, why are you doing this? But then her longtime personal physician countered with, she'll have heart failure if you don't. So I compromised. I decided we'll take the TEE test, which involves a tube down the throat to see how bad the heart valves are, but we won't do the surgery. Plans made, we waited for over 30 hours, during which time she pulled out her IV and bled profusely, and despite the request that she not eat at one point, she went to a roommate's tray and ate her entire lunch. Any lingering doubt I had was erased. Even if Mom made it through surgery, she wouldn't survive recovery. Her second doctor, a geriatric care physician, closed the deal. There's an unwritten rule in medicine, he said. Don't do the test if you're not prepared to do the surgery. So we made a break for it. Get dressed, I whispered conspiratorially. We're blowing this popsicle stand. We walked out like Thelma and Louise. Don't look left or right, I instructed. Just look straight ahead. We drove to a senior center and signed her up for dance classes. Soon we'll go see museums and get our nails done. We will not look back. I hope we're doing the right thing. As I write, I've been toying with a Ziploc bag of Mom's mementos. There's Dad's wartime medals from service at Guadalcanal, fabric-covered bars, some with stars, his marine pins. Of course I'm thinking about him this Memorial Day, as always. But this year, I'm also thinking of his wife. A less heralded member of the greatest generation, she welcomed home a husband who'd have lifelong thrashing nightmares, bore 7 children and lost 3 in childbirth, then navigated the bewildering terrain of divorce, the women's movement, and starting her own business. And she walked, with the erect bearing of the proud veteran of health care that she is, straight out of the hospital that really isn't going to do her any good anymore. Of course, she won't receive any medals for this, but this summer, we plan a hell of a parade. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as we pause to remember our war dead this Memorial Day, we're looking back to tell the story of a Civil War hero, Charles Russell Lowell. Born in Boston in 1835, Lowell led a brief but intense life that ended on a Virginia battlefield when he was just 29 years old. A volunteer in the Union Cavalry, Lowell was instrumental in the formation of the Massachusetts 54th, the regiment of black volunteer soldiers portrayed in the film Glory. His leadership helped the Union troops win the Battle of Cedar Creek in October 1864, and that Union victory helped President Lincoln win re-election just a few weeks later. Carol Bundy is the author of the new biography, The Nature of Sacrifice. She spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes at Lowell's gravesite in the Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Lowell's funeral was something that brought Boston together. He had died gloriously at the Battle of Cedar Creek, been one of the key figures in turning that from a humiliating Union defeat into a resounding victory that had broken the Confederate cavalry and won the Shenandoah Valley for the Union. And this was recognized to be something that Lincoln could ride into the election and would help win him the election. And Boston, which had been divided, had come together now. Enough young men had died, that families were reunited, and that Boston came together, and this funeral was one of those moments that really embraced all of that and pushed people out to the polls to support Lincoln.
What was it that happened in that battle with him that turned the battle for the Union?
Well, the Union troops had had a bunch of victories, and they were a little cocky. They imagined that the Confederates would not initiate a fight, and that everything lay in their hands. And so when at 5 in the morning the Confederates attacked the Union camps, their surprise was total and entire, and they overran the infantry camps, you know, spearing men in their tents. And panic was profound. You had three corps just running scared. And Lowell's cavalry, along with the rest of the cavalry, set off to the side without orders, watched initially, unsure what to do, and then Lowell took two brigades and led them, as if on parade, right across the battlefield between the Confederates and these fleeing Union camps, and drew fire onto his own men, really reoriented the energy of the battle. And that, what he was trying to do was cut the Confederates off from reaching Middletown. He did not succeed in that, but what he did manage to do was hold the Confederates in the town of Middletown and bought the time that Sheridan and the rest of the infantry generals needed to rally their men, so that by 4 in the afternoon there was a countercharge, and that countercharge swept in and just sent the Confederate cavalry once again fleeing. And it was that key moment of off his own bat recognizing that something had to be done and just coming in and doing it that was so remarkable.
Take us back a little further in his military career and talk about his experiences as a soldier. He helped to form the fabled Massachusetts 54th, the regiment of black volunteers, led by his cousin Robert Gould Shaw.
He had been an ADC to McClellan and had been with McClellan in the Peninsula Campaign and the Antietam Campaign, and had not participated enormously in the fighting himself. The cavalry at this point in the war was very poorly used. So his experience had been one of profound frustration and profound grief, as most of his friends and his brother, his cousins, killed. So it was with the kind of accumulated frustration and rage and grief that he returned to Boston, and as the war switched from being a war for the Union to a war for emancipation. And Lowell very much supported this. He had been an abolitionist as a young man, and he wanted the deaths of these men that he cared about to add up to something, to mean and something, and that's what it was going to mean for him. So he went in with a passion to helping find the officers needed to man the 54th Regiment, and his own 2nd Massachusetts Cavalry. The two regiments trained together at Reedville, and the experience that Lowell and his officers had was important in terms of lending credibility to the 54th. These were other white officers who could vouch for these black soldiers that nobody knew whether they could fight or not, and there was indeed much skepticism, some of it totally prejudiced, others, let's say, less so, if we can measure that kind of thing. But it was very important to have this kind of popular support, build some kind of popular support for this new experiment of black soldiers.
Tell us about Charles Lowell's death. He was only 29. He'd been made a brigadier general just the day before.
I think to keep the men calm, all the officers felt they had to be on the front line, and Lowell was not willing to give up that. And so he lay for about 4 hours as the army was regrouping. He had the newspaper read to him. There was a guy hawking a newspaper in this lull. And he just lay there, and they gave him a little whiskey, and he tried to gather his strength. I'm pretty sure he thought he was dying. He spoke of his bad lung, meaning he'd had tuberculosis as a much younger man, and he was trying to insist the wound wasn't that big a deal because it was only his bad lung that had been hurt. In any event, finally at 4 o'clock, he's asked to lead the charge. And I think that this was a recognition on the part of the other generals that he had played a huge role in the events, that he had saved their bacon, and that he was dying, and this was a soldier's way to go. And
one final act of glory.
Right. And he had said at the death of Robert Goldshaw, who had died at the head of his men, this is the way to die.
When you stand here in front of this site, what do you imagine would have been in store for him here in Boston, in Cambridge, had he survived the war and come back to live?
Well, lots of people speculated on that. I think they thought he could have been president. He had a way of drawing people to him that's, you know, bound for success. But how that would have evolved, given all the complicated events that then emerged in the post-war period, it's very hard to say, but it's a wonderful thing to think about.
Carol Bundy, very nice meeting you, and thanks very much for coming here to the Mount Auburn Cemetery and letting us chat.
Thank you very much.
Carol Bundy is the author of The Nature of Sacrifice, a biography of Charles Russell Lowell. She was speaking with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Robin Lubbock. Our newscast producer, Matt Largy. Our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.